I'm Tom Witt.
And I'm Dan Spencer.
And I don't even know what the name of this session is.
The name of this session is Kairos, a challenge to the church.
Yeah. And I'm going to start off here.
And I'm going to tell them what day it is on the tape.
Yeah, this is June 16th, Soweto Day, important day for particularly South Africans in their struggle to free themselves from apartheid. So we're doing this session in conjunction with that day as part of our observance. And later tonight, there will be a session on, I think, the more the current situation, what's going on in South Africa. But today, part of the reason that Dan and I are doing this is, or I guess the major reason is that we really need to listen to some folks who are speaking to us from other churches in other parts of the world. And South Africa is one of those places. And both of us have read some things that we want to share with you and that maybe you have read, but also to get your reactions and questions and comments. But we are, as North American Christians, being deeply challenged by Christian people in the third world as they begin to reflect on their own faith in light of the situations they find themselves in. And in several documents, they have defined their present time as Kairos time, and I guess it is up here. Kairos, as you probably know, is a Greek word found in the New Testament that means moment of truth, which is used also in the Kairos document, or a special time of decision. And the Kairos to which these documents testify, it explores how and why the poor are and continue to be crushed, really, by economic oppression and political exploitation and structural racism. And so they talk about, they look at the analysis of what's happening in their situation, but in the midst of it, they also talk about how God is calling them to a new life. It's a very special time of hope as well. Precisely because it is a Kairos time, there's opportunities now to be faithful in new ways of the gospel. So there are three documents that I'm referring to, and we're going to talk about two of them today. One is simply called The Challenge to the Church, the Kairos document from South Africa. The next one that came out, I believe, is called Kairos Central America. I don't remember what year. Was this 2 years ago maybe that this came out, 87? A Challenge to the Churches of the World. This was influenced, of course, by the Kairos document from South Africa, but coming from Central American theologians. And then the third one is Road to Damascus, Kairos and Conversion, which is Dan's going to talk about, comes from a variety of third world theologians and other Christians. We're not going to talk about Kairos Central America today, but it is in the Resource Center, so you can read it if you'd like, as well as these other two. And I guess my first hope is that by coming to the session, you would just simply read these documents. They're not that long. This one can be read certainly within a half an hour and get a grasp of what they're trying to say. And I think it's the real value of these is that they're short enough. They're not long theological dissertations, but they're really meant to be read by folks like you and me.
That's the thing, as Tom will probably say, they're produced out of the people's communities themselves, and so the wording of them is to speak to the people in their own condition rather than being theological treatises.
And I guess I would say our hope for today is not only that we would begin to understand better the Kairos time which those people find themselves in and have identified for themselves, but that we as North American Christians would begin to listen to what these folks have to say to us, and then in turn we begin to discern the Kairos for us, ourselves living as Christians in the United States or North America. We have our own racism to deal with, our own oppression, our own injustice that also relates to what they're going through. So I'm going to talk about Kairos document for about 15 minutes, and then Dan's going to talk about the Road to Damascus for 15 minutes, and then the last half hour will just simply be discussion about these and other implications for the church. Let me start with a little bit of background about the Kairos document. I think the most
important thing to say about it is the process through which it was written. Many people say that the process that was used was just as important as the document itself and what was actually produced. And so it's important that you understand there was a very intentional process. It's all started in, I think, the spring of 1985. And the context of this, if I understand what was happening in South Africa, was a period of intensified violence, escalating repression. And when we talk about the cycle of violence, this is really what we mean, that there was increased repression upon people of color in South Africa, who then began to reject a lot of the repression, to refuse to cooperate. And then the army comes back in with more state of emergency laws and military, and it's just a cycle that continues. So things were worsening, they were quite violent. And in that time, some theologians gathered together, feeling the need to somehow comment theologically on the political crisis in South Africa. And so what this document is, and it really is a document that has evolved over time, but it is basically an attempt of some Christian people in that country to analyze and to reflect on what was happening in their country, and then to expose some of the theological tenets or theological themes that influence how the church was responding to that political situation. And then also out of that, then it tries to present some alternative models that might lead the church to responding in some ways that are really quite helpful and might bring some significant change. So June in 1985, a group of people gathered, feeling the need to reflect, and there was a discussion group right at the beginning of the summer, right in the middle of Soweto, in the middle of all this violence that was happening. And it just allowed people an opportunity to talk freely about what was going on, and then to reflect theologically on it. And then those responses were critiqued, and the theology was critiqued. And then individuals in that meeting were assigned different tasks to put together some material and then to come back that would expand on some of these themes. A second meeting was called, which got a little bit deeper into all of the themes that were brought up. And again, individual people were assigned to dig deeper and to do some more research. There's a third meeting called together yet that summer, where it was theologians, lay people from the church, as well as some church leaders. More adjustments were made in the document. And then a working committee was called together that was appointed to actually go out and seek responses, seek critiques by people all across the country. So the document was very much presented as a people's document that people were supposed to respond to critique, disagree with if they wanted, and then it would constantly be revised. And as they agreed to do a second revision, I guess the second edition of the Kairos document was done about a year later. And so it is continually changing. In the end, I think in when it was published in September of 1985, about 151 people signed this, including theologians, lay people, church leaders. And then I think now it's thousands of people who have signed this document. And it received quite a bit of press. And I think the writers of it, thanked the South African government for a lot of the press it received, because the South African government responded so negatively to it that it created a lot of uproar. Perhaps I was thinking, if something was written like this here, it would just simply be ignored, and maybe that would be the best way to deal with it. But it was not ignored. In fact, it was compared to something like the Barman Declaration of the Confessing Church in Germany in the 1930s, when that document was written, really represents a solid theological critique of a regime. So I'm just going to run down these five sections of it and just sort of highlight what I think is important in this document for us to understand, then give it over to Dan. First of all, just to understand what they mean by Kairos time, and really the term that they use is moment of truth. That's how they describe Kairos time, and I'll quote from the document. It's a special time when God visits God's people to offer them a unique opportunity for repentance and conversion, for change and decisive action. It's a moment of truth, a crisis. It's important to understand, too, that they're speaking primarily to, as Christian people, to other Christian people. So it's a moment of truth for the churches. It's not just a moment where there is terrible repression going on in the country. That seems to happen most of the time. But it's a time when the church has clearly failed to respond adequately to that oppression, and the church has become complicit in the oppression. So that's what a kairos time is, and it's not something that necessarily people choose their own kairos, but it's something that God is calling them to. So the church now needs to be confronted with its complicity and its unfaithfulness, and that's what the kairos document is speaking to. And what was the reality and still is the reality today in South Africa is that instead of taking a clear stand on this oppression, the church has been divided. There isn't really just one church in South Africa, there's really two. There's a white church and a black church, and both claiming to live the same gospel, but both saying very different things. And so kairos time means that these people are saying, there is no middle road anymore. You have to decide where you stand, because the lines are clearly drawn, and there comes a time when you can't sit on the fence anymore. And it's simply a call to say, please decide where you stand, discard your neutrality. God is calling us to speak with words and action. So that's sort of their introduction to the times, the signs of the times that they find themselves in. Then it proceeds with sort of the body of it is in these three sections, state theology, church theology, and prophetic theology. And those three sections really start with a recognition that there are different theologies going on in South Africa and in other parts of the world that compete with each other. And that a theology can either encourage oppression or it can encourage liberation. And they critique these just to sort of expose, first of all, the state theology is a very well articulated critique of state theology and how that theology encourages oppression. State theology is just another word for the South African apartheid state theology, and we don't usually think of states as having theologies, but it's impossible for that kind of oppression to exist without a theology behind it. It's essentially a theological justification of racism, of the status quo, and justifies the oppression of the poor by really distorting theology, and they use a number of examples, but it's a theology that blesses the will of the white minority. It reduces the poor to just be passive people and to be obedient. One of the examples they point out, the way that state theology works, is the use of the misuse of Romans 13, 1-7, and I'm sure do people know what that is. How does it start again? Be obedient to...
Be subject to the government.
It's probably the most misused text in the Bible, I would say, at least in the New Testament. So it's not just happening in South Africa. It happens here as well. But Romans 13 is used in South Africa to really encourage blind obedience to the apartheid regime. And it's taken out of context so that it seems to mean that God demands complete obedience to an evil regime or to a repressive regime. That's one of the examples they use. Another they use is the whole use in South Africa of law and order, that there's a tremendous emphasis through, again, martial law, but what do they use in South Africa? State of emergency. There's a concept of really needing law and order. But in fact, it's unjust law and unjust disorder. And though that state of law and order is made out to seem normal, the way things should be, so that to resist those laws is painted as somebody being disorderly or sinful. And they go into quite a bit of detail about how law and order is used. The third is the threat of communism. It's not something that we're unfamiliar with, but every state needs in some ways to have its symbol of evil in the world
its example of what hell would be like. And South Africa uses this to a great degree of defining any person who's resistant to apartheid to be a communist. And any other model other than the status quo is labeled communist and equated them with supreme evil. And the fourth example they use is the way in which the name of God is used in South Africa. Not only through, for instance, military chaplains in the South African Defense Force, but chaplains to the apartheid parliament. I forget what their body of legislature is called. But the name of God is invoked by the state quite a bit, particularly in their constitution. And if you ever have a chance to read it, it's tremendous how the name of God is used. But it's a God who sides only on the side of whites. On the side of the oppressor. And the Kairos document simply critiques this as saying it's blasphemy to use the name of God in that way, to assume that God is on the side of the white minority and gives most of the land to this white minority. Church theology is the sort of the second big critique, and this is different in that this critiques the dominant theology coming out of the white white and black English-speaking churches in South Africa. This is a theology that tends to be pretty critical of apartheid, but in a very cautious way. And the Kairos document says because it is so cautious, it ends up being counterproductive. And just a couple of examples that they use is that the Kairos document authors say, instead of really doing adequate in-depth analysis of what's happening, the church tends to just sort of lay out there these stock phrases, theological phrases, like one of the examples they use is reconciliation. We need to be reconciled with one another as though this conflict is between, you know, a quarrel between two friends that just needs to get the people together to talk. In fact, the situation is much different from that. There is an oppressor and there is the oppressed, and without the presence of justice, there can be no reconciliation. And so this is a tremendous critique of what the churches are saying. Oh, you just need to be reconciled, but there is no reconciliation without repentance on the part of the oppressed and without justice. Also, in the way in which the church uses justice, the writers of the Kairos document ask, what kind of justice are you talking about? Are you talking about a top-down justice, which the white minority will decide what sort of reforms to apply to the state of apartheid? Or are you talking about a bottom-up justice that really is radical revolution and a whole new system? And then the way in which the church uses the word nonviolence. This is used quite a bit in South Africa, that they call both sides to be nonviolent. And the problem that the writers have with this is that, again, it doesn't take into context what's happening, as though you can just simply call what's happening on both sides violence without distinguishing between the kinds of violence, the structural, institutional violence, and then people trying to respond and to defend themselves, sometimes using violence. And then they do a little bit of a biblical critique of violence in the Bible. I found this interesting. I didn't know this before, but violence in the Bible, in the Old Testament particularly, is never used to describe people defending themselves. Violence is always used to describe what oppressors do to the oppressed. And so they do a little bit of theological analysis there. But finally, this section, I think what was most helpful to me is that their main critique is that the church fails really to do adequate social analysis. The church doesn't really explore deeply what's going on in the society, but uses these absolute principles and throws them out, like reconciliation and justice and nonviolence, and just applies them pretty much uncritically to all situations. But very little is done by the church to analyze what's happening. And the Kairos document says it's not helpful to throw these theological phrases at us without doing and judge our actions without really understanding what's going on in the society. Prophetic theology is what they're proposing publicly affirmed, that the churches in South Africa need prophetic theology. And the first part of prophetic prophetic theology would be simply to do the social analysis. The quote that I thought was helpful is, a prophetic theology must try to read the signs of the times, or to interpret this kairos. It must analyze what is happening, in other words, do the social analysis, and then interpret what is happening in the light of the gospel. So first you do the analysis, and then you interpret it in the light of what's happening in the gospel. The starting point for prophetic theology will be our experience and the present kairos, our experience of oppression and tyranny, our experience of conflict, crisis, and struggle, our experience of trying to be Christians in this situation. It is with this mind that we must begin to search the scriptures. I found that very helpful, that we don't come to scriptures with a blank slate. Everyone comes with a mindset, and the mindset that these people have to come to the scriptures with is the mindset of being an oppressed people, and that we can't pretend that we somehow come to scriptures without that mindset. Then that this section has a pretty long biblical and theological analysis of a couple of things. The search, once you do the analysis, you search the Bible for the Bible's meaning of what oppression is. And they have a very long session on both on oppression in the Old Testament primarily and Christian experience of tyranny. And they finally come to the point that to declare the South African government as a tyrannical ruler. And that because it's a tyranny, it will not voluntarily reform itself, but it needs to be replaced. And they do that through theological reflection. I thought it was fascinating. And then the last thing that the prophetic theology would say about it is that it calls people to action. It's a very hopeful theology. It's not something that is primarily concerned with otherworldly things, but it calls people to conversion, to action. It is hopeful, confrontational, costly, deeply spiritual, thoroughly practical, and pastoral. Let me just end then by saying it ends with a fairly brief call to action because I think they hope that churches will discuss this and come to their own sorts of conclusions about what action to take. But the main thing they start with is that what the churches need to be saying most clearly is that God is on the side of the oppressed. That if the church says that, it will no longer be divided. And that's why the church is divided, because part of the church is saying God sides with the oppressed, and part of the church is not saying that. So that the only way to unify the church is for everyone to jump over to this side and say God sides with the oppressed. That's the only way that we can reach unity, is unity through God and Christ. And God is saying that he's on the side of the oppressed. Then, starting from that point, then the church needs to do a lot more in terms of participating in the struggle of the South African people. Up until this point, they say that the church has been involved mostly in sort of an ambulance mentality or an ambulance ministry and not really participating in the struggle for change. Then church activities need to be changed. For instance, if we are in reality and part of the struggle, then we need to change the way we look at baptism. The evil that rejecting needs to be named. We need to think about Eucharist in a different way. The unity around which we come around the table needs to be openly declared. We need to talk about repentance and name the things we repent from. So that we're talking about enlivening the church through its rituals. And then finally, the church needs to be involved in all the special campaigns that are going on in the country. They're really calling the church to specifically side with campaigns that that other South Africans are involved in, including the possibility of civil disobedience. So I think those action kinds of suggestions are primarily geared towards South Africans and South African Christians, but it's important to understand that the Kairos Ecumen also speaks to us, because we are part of their oppression. And maybe after Dan now does Road to Damascus, we could get into a discussion about what this document means for us. Why don't you take it then for another 15 minutes?
Yeah, I'm going to talk a little bit about a document that's less than a year old. It came out in July last year, called The Road to Damascus, Kairos and Conversion. And it's both continuous with and different from the Kairos document. The analogy I would use is, I think the Kairos document focuses on the situation in South Africa. It's the testimony of South African Christians about how they understand what's happening there. I think the Kairos document has played a role a lot like Paul's letters did, or the early Gospels, which were, what's recorded in Acts is these letters were sent from Christian community to Christian community with the little trailer that said, it seemed good to us and the Holy Spirit to write this down and send to you. If it's helpful for you, this is how we see our situation. The Kairos document ended up being circulated around the world, and Christians from all over the world, but particularly places where they were suffering severe oppression, resonated with what was in the Kairos document. And they began to say, we need to talk to each other further about how we're understanding our faith. The result of that was about 2.5 years worth of conversation that ended up in this little document called The Road to Damascus, Kairos and Conversion. It emerged from conversations from Christians on 3 continents, in 7 countries. In Africa, Christians came from South Africa and Namibia. In Central America, they came from El Salvador, Nicaragua, and Guatemala. And in Asia, they came from South Korea and the Philippines. But from these 7 different contexts, they came together to reflect on their faith and come up with a document to challenge the rest of the church, and known as the Road to Damascus. I've got some notes here and stuff, and I'd do better if I can hop around a little bit. But just a little talk about that's the background and the purpose. What these Christians found is that they held a number of things in common. Primarily, as Thomas talked about, they understood their faith, and they understood Christian faith to be a commitment to the poor and the oppressed. That the God that we worship in the Christian faith is a God of the poor and the oppressed. And all of these Christians from these 7 countries realized that they had all come out of an experience of colonization and exploitation by more powerful countries. In Africa and Latin America, this began in both European and North American countries, and the Philippines the same. In South Korea, it was exploitation by Japan, but they had all been colonies of more powerful countries, and religion had been used in their colonization and exploitation, principally Christianity. Where they found themselves today in all these countries was a situation of violent political conflict where the church was found on both sides, or is found on both sides. And so that's the context that led to what they discussed. In the introduction to Road to Damascus, they say they have four small chapters, and they say here are the main reasons. In chapter 1, they're trying to lay forth the historical and political roots of the conflict. I've just listed it up here. In chapter 2, to talk about the perspective of faith seen from the perspective of the oppressed. In chapter 3, how the church recaptures its prophetic mission. How we condemn the sins of those who are oppressing and exploiting. The final chapter is how we are called back to a call to conversion to all of us, back to the true faith. And they use the symbol of the road to Damascus to give allusion to Paul's journey. We are all pretty familiar with that probably, but at this time Saul was persecuting the Christians and was full of zeal, as his religious zeal of doing this. And then on the road to Damascus was confronted by Jesus confronting him on his persecution, and Paul undergoes a conversion to understanding God and Jesus in a new light. Basically, moving from persecutor to into communities that were being persecuted from their faith. I'm going to go through and just stress a couple of highlights. I really encourage people to read this. This is it's a fascinating little pamphlet, and it reads really quickly, but it also is very jarring because of one of the things it does, we'll get down to here too, is it recaptures biblical and faith-filled language on the side of social justice. Oftentimes it felt like people who would get involved in social justice leave behind their faith in order to talk about it. And this, the Road to Damascus is explicitly starts talking about things like apostasy, blasphemy, heresy, idolatry. And it was a real jar for me because I think that part of the language, the vocabulary, has been taken by one side of the church and the rest of the church doesn't use it so much anymore. But going back to some of the roots of the conflict, it's real important to understand how they root understand their arguments, and they do it from both a biblical and a historical approach. For Christians from this perspective, it's very critical to understand what has happened to the church in the first 3 centuries and since that time. And they put the key event as being the conversion of Constantine, when Christianity becomes the official religion of the Roman Empire. Up until this time, Christianity of the first three centuries was a fairly small, persecuted minority religion of a number of small communities that were persecuted by the empire. However, after the time of Constantine, Christianity becomes the official religion of the empire and is used then to justify the empire's conquest. The claim of the authors of the Road to Damascus is that that has been the kind of Christianity that was imported and imposed in their situations through the colonization, becoming colonies of their things, and then now is still used to justify the kind of exploitation that goes on in their countries. The result of that then has been that there is a church that's become very divided. The official Christianity that was taught was used to justify the imposition of the colonies and the exploitation of the indigenous people. However, even very early on in all of their situations, there were people who rebelled against this or protested this understanding of the faith, and so you end up with a divided church. They, in the second chapter, they simply talk more about, and I'm not going to go into much here because Tom has dealt with it a little bit, this difference between the God of the rich, or the God who sides with the powerful and justifies oppression, versus what they will claim is not as God siding with the poor and the oppressed. So it's a reaffirmation of the faith of the oppressed and the poor in these situations struggling for liberation. The part I want to talk a little bit more about is this, in this third area, the chapter called The Recapturing the Prophetic Mission of the Church. I thought this one was particularly challenging for us, and it was a very important one for us to look at briefly before we go on to discussion. They begin the chapter with the question, why are Christians so often silent in the face of injustice and suffering? Let me just read a little excerpt from here in response to this question. It says, for some of us, the reason lies in a life that is not confronted by the suffering and the struggle of the poor, and therefore the choice of a convenient God who does not challenge us to take part in a movement for change. For others, however, the reason lies in a choice of privilege and power and a conscious defense of the status quo. For such people, it is not simply an inability to see and hear, it is a refusal to see and hear. It is not merely lack of faith in the God of life, it is worship of a false God, the sin of idolatry. In both cases, there's a false understanding of the gospel, where one is unconscious and the other one is consciously worshiping a false god. And the challenge of the folks in Road to Damascus is to expose what kind of false god and what false religion is taking place to justify the oppression they suffer. They go through, and section by section, on some of the five classic sins here. And I just want to point out a couple of them as we go through them. But if I were to ask you, I'm going to ask you in each one of these, what is idolatry, the sin of idolatry? And Jane's going to back us up if the rest of you don't come in, so she's going to prep it.
I forgot to say that too.
The sin of idolatry, what is it?
Making something into God.
Okay, making something into God that is not God. So worshiping something that is not God as if that were God. In the document, they claim this is the primary sin present in much of the church now that has divided the church, and particularly in the right-wing sectors of the church. They claim that the sin today is the worship of money, power, privilege, and pleasure, and that has replaced the worship of God. And their claim is that this idol, what's so damaging about the idol, is that it's anti-people, fundamentally. That when we begin to worship these other things, it demands a tremendous sacrifice of people. They go back through the Old Testament and look at what happened when Israel fell into worshiping of idols and the kind of demands those idols made on the people, and draw some amazing parallels to what's happening today. For one thing, worshiping idols demand absolute submission and blind obedience. And they talk about in their own situation, for example, the total emphasis on capitalism and the free market, that is the law, there can be no exceptions to that. You have to have blind obedience to that, and the tremendous cost that invokes on the people there. That idols involve the denial of all hope for the future. Idols will make the claim that this is the way the world is. There's no sense in trying to change it at all. It's just the way the world is. And therefore, they withdraw any hope of change for the poor and the oppressed. Idols always promise security in exchange for worship. If you simply get a larger bank account, if you simply invest your money here, if you simply do all these things, you'll get security out there, rather than trusting in God for our security. Idols demand a scapegoat. And Tom has already lifted up the primary one here of communism. Any attempt to change the system gets labeled communism, which de facto is evil, therefore there's no need to try and change it. And scapegoats are created in order to prevent people from worshiping the true God. The one that I thought was fascinating was idols demand human sacrifice. And they say it's not coincidental that tens of thousands of people of faith are being sacrificed or being massacred and killed in their countries because the idols demand the sacrifice of anything that competes with them for worship. Finally, idols are fanatical. They demand total obedience, and they do this through lies. They do lies that are based on deceiving the people. They make claims on the reality that are false and demand total obedience to that, and then they build this with lie after lie after lie. And so it's the kind of thing where you start seeing the things we had to destroy the village in order to save it, peace is war, all these kinds of things become a total 180-degree inversion of the reality. Okay, we'll go through the rest of these a little more quickly, but what about heresy? I had to review some of these, I have to confess, when I first read this, it had been so long since I dealt with some of these concepts. Mm-hmm. One thing you might, heresy literally comes from the word choice. And what heresies are partial truths.
Well, from someone in seminary.
Yes.
We learn this in church history, and then when you start your sequence of systematic theology, you go back and look at it again. And in almost all the famous heresies are named after different individuals, and these were all upstanding figures in the church who were onto the truth and went too far.
Okay.
It's pushing too hard. It's pushing too hard, and you end up making answers because it's not an evil thing.
Right. Heresy tends to be things that are rooted in the truth, rooted in Christian faith, but because they either go too far or because they focus only on one segment to exclusion of the other, they end up distorting their Christian faith. In the Kairos Dogma, the situation of Kairos Dogma in South Africa, they have the doctrine of apartheid has been declared heresy officially by the churches there. They say that apartheid now fundamentally distorts the Christian truth. In the Road to Damascus, they are challenging us to look at other places where we have fallen into heresy. And some of them are, Tom was saying, respect for authorities has been turned into blind submission to the state, regardless of whether the state is evil or not. That is a heresy. Another one they talk about is where our Christian faith oftentimes calls us into make distinctions between opposing things like spirit and matter, things like this. These have been turned into fundamental antagonistic dualisms that now war against each other. So we no longer just make the distinction. We have earth versus heaven, spirit versus matter, man versus woman. And so there, and then one of the fundamental heresies then is also spiritualizing religion. Instead of holding spirituality in tension with other parts of our faith, it's become set in dualism, and we've spiritualized religion, and then the rest of our life becomes non-religious. These they name as heresies, are the distortions of the Christian faith, and call us to renounce them. How about apostasy?
Forsaking, okay.
Okay, apostasy is the active decision to leave the faith.
It's a turning away.
And it comes from in the early period of the first three centuries when there was such active persecution of Christians that the breaking point was whether or not a Christian would renounce God or renounce Jesus, renounce the faith, faced with this persecution. So apostasy is a decision to renounce the faith. Well, what the members or the authors of the book call us here is to say that while there are many places where there is no explicit renunciation of faith, people through their actions in fact have renounced the faith. And particularly a faith that was based on communities that were faithful to the gospel and became persecuted of that, there are now many, many people who are in the churches who are persecuting others. And so while they may not renounce the faith in name, their actions have led to the abandonment of the Christian faith. hypocrisy, I think, is one that we know fairly well from the teachings of Jesus. Their point here is that if we look at the teachings of Jesus, he was very harshest, perhaps the most harsh in his denunciation of the hypocrisy of the religious leaders of his time, who preached one thing and lived another. We even had a parable of Matins this week that talked about the hypocrisy of saying one thing and living on another. In the situation where these Christians are found, this is something they face all the time, is that the religious leaders have become invested with power, and so they, as Tom was saying, they will make denunciations or they will say one thing, but their actions are divorced from that, and particularly end up contributing to the persecution of Christians. Final one, blasphemy. What would be the classic definition?
Taking the Lord's name in vain.
If idolatry is rooted in the first commandment, you shall have no other gods in front of me. Blasphemy rooted in the second, you shall not take the Lord's name in vain. Again here, the blaspheme is taking God's name and using it in a way that distorts who God is. And the Christians here say that time and again, God's name is used to justify the exploitation and persecution they're experiencing. They experience this as a blasphemy. I'll just finish up then saying the fourth point, which I ran out of room, which is the call to conversion. The Road to Damascus ends with a chapter on Paul's story and simply says, we are faced with a similar kind of thing now, where we have the church has become involved in persecuting those who are taking the faith seriously, and we need to answer the call of Christ back to a true understanding of the faith. I think I'll just leave it there.
Yeah. Well, yeah, let's open it up for, as Dan and I talked about, we thought there may be questions about either of these documents and the role they play, but also I think eventually we want to open it up into our own discussion about, you know, what confronts us about the content of these documents and not just stay on their, how they were written or specifics about them, but
yeah.
Well, this is a comment, okay, yeah. It's not a question. But I'm just so struck by these religious words you said. We don't use them, I think it's because we're so uncomfortable in defining what's right and wrong belief. We're happy to call behavior right and wrong. I mean, I have to say that is wrong behavior because you are persecuting somebody. But in this world, especially of 20th century America, we don't say that your belief is wrong. We just say, oh, isn't that interesting what you believe? I mean, the words I'm struck is like Islamic words that really are very uncomfortable for me, especially apostasy. I mean, that's the great sin in Islam. You fall away from Islam. Salman Rushdie has to die, not just because what he wrote, because he went away from Islam. So really judging people, I mean, saying that there is a right belief and a wrong belief, is very uncomfortable for us. So this is something new for me.
Well, and that's a very helpful comment, because one of the things that these Christians are challenging us with is overcoming a false dualism between belief and action. For them, they're very integrated, and I think one of the reasons why they name these things are so jarring is because they say what we actually believe is revealed in our actions. And that's where, particularly like the charge of hypocrisy, we can talk and talk and talk about Thomas saying sort of these principles that float in the air about reconciliation, things like that, but we only give content to those in terms of how we're living. And so what they're calling us to do is take account of the way our behaviors reveal what our true beliefs are. We can talk till we're blue in the face about worshiping the God of Jesus Christ, but if in fact our actions reveal that our security is based in the idolatry of money and power, then there's a contradiction, and our true beliefs are being revealed by the way we live. But that is a real helpful comment.
And I don't think it would be on every single issue that there would be the Christian way and the non-Christian way, but in the context of a Kairos time, there is no way to sort of sit in the middle, that you have to choose one way or the other, and there's sort of no middle ground. Like in Nazi Germany, the time when Hitler was coming to power, there was no... That's what the Confessing Church was saying. And so there would be some things that would be, what's a traditional word is adiaphora, a matter of indifference. I mean, Christians can be a part of different denominations, believe this, believe that. But in the context of this, what they're saying is that there's some very clear places where we need to line up.
That's real helpful, because I wouldn't want to leave people with the impression this is a new fundamentalism, that there's only one way on everything.
Yeah.
In fact, I think they say in several places there's a lot of room for Christian debate on a lot of matters, but as Tom said, you sometimes reach a kairos moment where things do come down to black and white, either or kinds of decisions.
Other comments or questions?
Can you tell us anything about this group that is calling for the study of the documents? And I've gathered some of the information there that I've come to hand. And do you know anything about that group or where it's at?
You're talking about in the States here.
This group that signed the letter, was in that file.
Yeah, again, you can read this because there's two copies, I think, in this file that actually belongs to the Resource Center, and we can set it out. But there is a group of some theologians and grassroots folks from churches in the United States who have been taken by what this is saying to us and saying, now it's time perhaps for us to begin looking at what our kairos time is and what our action that God is calling us to, and begin to reflect on that. So I'll just read some of the names: Robert McAfee Brown, Richard Shaw, George Hunzinger, Rosemary Radford Ruther, Jim Wallace from Sojourners, Carter Haywood from Union Seminary. Is that where she's at?
She's from Episcopal Divinity School.
Some of these kinds of folks have gotten together and written a letter and just said, start reading this stuff, first of all, and discuss it in your own communities, and then keep in correspondence. And I think it's similar to what was started in the very early stages of the confessing movement in Germany, is that they first started committees of correspondence, that people kind of said, hey, I'm sensing that this is happening. Are you sensing the same thing? And then people started communicating with each other. That eventually led to the Bomber Declaration and some real resistance. So that's the stage that things are at. They're asking people simply to read these documents, to discuss them in their communities of faith, and then to begin to discern what is it that we need to be doing as North American Christians specifically. And some of this will now be carried on in the next year. There is an annual gathering that I've been a part of for the last few years at Kirkridge Retreat Center, a place very much like Holden in some ways in Pennsylvania, where the representatives of the peace and justice movement from the Christian church meets, and their conversation is going to be on this issue this fall in October. And the other piece that fits into this is the World Council of Churches focus on peace, justice, and the integrity of creation. They just had their world gathering in Seoul, Korea, and the American participants, the North American participants of that, came back and said, what they felt they really needed to participate in shaping is the church's response to 1992 and the so-called discovery of America by Columbus. Mm-hmm. And that will be a very crucial issue or a handle by which to maybe get a hold of some of these broader issues of kairos. That how will the church interpret Columbus's invasion? And will it be called an invasion? Will it be called a discovery? And will it be a celebration? So. For people of color, particularly in the churches, this is going to be a crucial issue in this country.
Tom neglected to mention just a couple of the signatures of the letter are going to be on teaching staff in the next, or will be here at the Village in the next month. Bill Dexheimer will be coming back with Tom.
Bill Dexheimer comes next week, and Jack Nelson Palmer the week after. And if you're still here, I would say go to any of Jack's.
Yeah, Jack will deal with a lot of this stuff, and he's really well versed in it.
I know at least three that have been here.
Before. Yeah, Rosemary. Mm-hmm.
Rosemary's been here.
McAfee Brown.
That's just a very small group that started the discussion. Now, this has been circulated in a sort of broad fashion, and obviously the big disadvantage of this group is that it's all white. And so the conscious effort now is to have this conversation be a multicultural, multiracial discussion.
Carter Haywood?
Hmm?
I thought Carter Haywood was she's white.
Looking at that whole thing makes me feel like the church has been looking at the scripture and gospel with one eye, not seeing the whole thing, and not willing to, you know. Can't get into the political, you know, you have real arguments with that. Even if you're having discussion groups, and they still don't think it belongs. But I feel like we're missing half of it. We don't include the whole justice issue.
Yeah. Well, one of the real fundamental challenges of these folks is to reorient the basic questions that the church asks in its mission work. Because traditionally the church has asked, do you believe in God? That's been the basic question of whether you're a believer or a non-believer. And so the question of atheism has been really critical. They're switching that the emphasis from atheism to idolatry. They're saying the fundamental question is not do you believe in God, but in which God do you believe? Do you believe in a God that justifies suffering, or do you believe in a God that calls us to resist suffering and oppression? And it's particularly important because many of these Christians come from Christian contexts. The people in Latin America, the entire country calls itself Christian. And yet there you have the phenomenon that Christians are torturing Christians, Christians are killing Christians. It's not a question of whether or not they believe in God. It's what kind of God do they believe in. And so they're calling the church to a real shift in how we phrase the key questions of our faith.
Maybe another way to look at that too is it may be helpful for those of us who are Lutherans too, is that when I think about looking at with one eye, that some people have written that we had the first Reformation, you know, that we are justified by faith and God's grace, but that maybe there's a need for a second Reformation now, so that the second Reformation being that God is on the side of the poor and that we need to be about their liberation, that really is what is coming, and maybe that's the other eye sort of opening up. I don't know if that's a helpful analogy or not.
You feel like there's a start here, right here, because you've broadened it and bringing in the other cultures and really opening our eyes that it's not just the Lutheran table at Eucharist, it's mm-hmm. the Lord's table.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And a good example, I think, is right here.
I think this is one of the things that really integrates with the whole and summer theme of on earth as in heaven,
yeah,
because right. when you shift this way of understanding what God is calling us to do, It's a call on behalf of life to resist anything that oppresses life, including destruction of the environment and the Earth's community. And so it's a way of affirming that God is a God of life, not a God of destruction.
Well, you know, when our discussion yesterday afternoon, 4 o'clock one, we talked about, you know, how is the world going to change, you know, and you know, Al Pitcher says, well, you know, we listen to the earth and he believes that things are going to get so bad that God's going to show us through the destruction that's going to come, because when the climate changes come, you know, there's going to be more earthquakes, hurricanes, you know, just the change in if the tropics, at the equator, if that goes up a couple degrees, hurricanes now, you know, at 170 miles an hour, that we can't even imagine how destructive they are. 270 miles an hour, so that hurricanes will take out 20 miles along the coast. And this last one that came along the coast of Georgia, it was the first time ever that trees were blown down, you know, 20 miles in. That was nothing. But how can we change? You know, well, I really do think that the, you know, we have to change our whole outlook. The Western world is such a consumer mentality. It's so materialistic, and that is so anti-gospel. I find, you know, reading the four gospels to be so challenging. I think it's such a radical thing to be a Christian. But yet, that's not the way I grew up. That's mm-hmm. not what I heard. I heard that it was hard not to be a sinner. You know, but this stuff didn't fit in. You know what. But you hear more and more about it. People are realizing that, you know, that there's a Sunday and a Monday church, and that you read things about, you know, lay people just saying that, you know, the pastor doesn't help them at all, you know, as far as being a Christian in their job. It really, hypocrisy means having two minds, and I think that's what a lot of us have. You know, we are Christians on Sunday in one way, and then we're able to somehow figure out how to go out into the world and not to be that type of Christian, not to be that type of person. So what I find is in these documents, when you go down the line, what they said, all those things just sort of match up point for point with Western materialism. The same theology and mindset that that the white oppressors have to have in South Africa to justify what they're doing is a relative of what we all participate in this country. Because, I mean, 5% of the world's population uses up 25% of the resources. You know, how are we getting away with that?
Thank you. Other comments or questions? Is this stuff that seems completely way out there, or is it the kind of stuff that says, well, I've sort of been thinking this, but I haven't had a way to articulate it, and this is a helpful framework? Or is there stuff that you just really disagree with?
I don't want to dominate, but I just want to say one more thing. I mean, I was studying the Kairos document from Central America a year and a half ago, and I've been wanting to read the South Africa one. I noticed that you have the Central America one
there. Yeah, I think I noticed that before you came in, that all three of them will be in the Resource Center.
Mm-hmm. In this Creation magazine, they pulled out Point 55. That thing reads, the Central America one reads great. It's point by point. And they really do. They just accuse that their idolatry. I mean, they call it the god of Western civilization is the idol that we worship, and it's very challenging. First time I read it, you know, no. Mm-hmm. But the more you look at it, it's.
I'll raise one of my questions that I have, and I think I know Jack Nelson Palmer struggles with this too, and he's beginning to do it, but the question is, how do you even begin to raise some of this in your average congregation, where people, you know, are experiencing their own kind of pain that seems pretty distant from this? I don't know, maybe there's lots of connections that I haven't been able to make yet, but... it seems so far removed from the average congregation where people are, and what they're thinking about, and the tendency in amidst all folks' pains to simply be really pastoral and to try to take care of their needs, and that this seems to be so confrontive that you don't want to even get into it. But there has to be a way in which I think this is also pastoral to people to begin to expose some of this, because it's part of our oppression too, I think. I'm not trying to do that though. Maybe Jack will have some answers by the time he gets up here, because I know he's been speaking about this quite a bit in congregations. But.
Are people who are involved in this, do they go out, or have they been making videos or anything like that that you can use in education for them?
Well,
we have a real good response in our adult education. It's bigger and bigger because of new things we're bringing in. But you really need to, you know, for me to bring it back, I need some real backing about it.
Well, I think that they're doing some of that. They're also asking people to educate themselves and then to go out. So that was the purpose of this mailing that was sent out, and it has a bibliography, it has where to get the Kairos documents, it has little summaries of the three documents, and then it has a guide to reflection, suggestion for Bible study, and then questions to help us learn from third world peoples, and questions to help us discern our Kairos. So I don't know what the Xeroxing policy is, or if people want to just sort of take a look at this sometime.
I guess I think there's absolutely enough here to start any discussion.
Yeah.
My problem is my self-examination, first of all, before I get into discussion, because I can't really think of anything I'm doing right.
Yeah.
You know, I'm part of this total system. Every meal I go to, I eat food that contributes to this system.
We're in it, whether we want to be or not. You know, we're victims of the whole idolatry process. Yeah.
I don't know. I would like to think that this would challenge us at our most basic level, because just about, I mean, trivialize is a word I just find myself using more and more in relation to our society and our religion, that we have trivialized things of the utmost importance. And the spiritualizing of religion, in fact, was a way of trivializing what was demanded of us, in my estimation, and that maybe again. And And so often when we start trying to talk about what we're going to do, and okay, I don't want to condemn doing something small because that's what I can do, but I just think it's gotten so far beyond doing something small because that's what we can do where we're at, that it's beginning to become ludicrous. And that's where our despair stems from. And when I heard about this, and I collected all this stuff together, and I really haven't had time to pursue it, I had hoped, because I saw that this is a way of taking it right back to the root. This is a way of taking it back to that most basic essential level, and maybe getting at the roots instead of fiddling around the outsides, which I feel we do so much.
Well, I don't know if this gets to your question, Tom. It does in some ways in terms of the what we do in our congregations, but one of the things I find exciting about a place like Holden is it's a place to experiment and start modeling some different ways that feel overwhelming when I'm out there by myself. If I've got a community of people around me who say, okay, once a week we'll eat potatoes and we'll take that money and we'll donate it. And then you have a Dick Kane who comes in here and teaches us how to write letters and do political advocacy. And then you've got, I mean, there's lots of different ways to start modeling slowly changing our lifestyle so that, you know, you end up where Al Pitcher is, who doesn't eat meat anymore, whatever, you know, and they're, but always connecting it at several different levels. And I think one of the keys is, you know, Tom has identified that in our congregations there are people who are experiencing pain at lots of different levels. And so when we do this response, it needs to be a liberating response for everybody. It has to be a way that, you know, like when you find ways to turn off the television, that leads to better quality time with your family and your friends and other things. So that these things are helping to liberate us from that. Because I think that's the, you know, the flip side of the oppression that our system causes for other people is that it just is a big, it's like a big Bayer aspirin. It just anesthetizes us. It's always trying to keep us from avoiding dealing with our own pain here through consuming more or whatever more. And when you start to break through that, the problem is the first thing it does is begin to reveal what enormous levels of pain there are. And that can be pretty overwhelming. But as we start to creatively find ways to address that pain and transform that system.
Right. Also making connections, helping people make the connections between pain and experience and this kind of thing. Because I think they're there to be made. I think of, for instance, one organization that I think beginning to do some of that, and that's the Pastoral Care Network for Social Responsibility. I think that's very helpful.
One thing I think we shouldn't disregard in reference to how do we do about it, how do we go about it, what do we do in local congregations, is that the gospel itself is very radical. And I think along with the kinds of things you might be introducing today in our congregations, that there has to be sound New Testament teaching about the life of Christ and what he would do.